Pack session number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, Reel 5. Now, well, we're talking about your dual training on the chipmunk trainer. We've gone through the sort of simple things of the dual instruction. What about after circuits and landing? What was the next phase? Or was the next phase the solo?
Before solo.
Before solo.
Yeah. my instructors, one imagines, weren't A2s then, which meant they weren't qualified to send me off solo themselves. So I can remember flying with the flight commander. His name was Lewis from memory, Flight Lieutenant Lewis. And he basically just gave me the okay in terms of being able to send me off. And I had to check this up because I've got concertinaed memories sometimes over a period, but that was from Cranwell North Airfield, because subsequently, you know, and even before that, I was flying from Spitalgate as well. And then there was Barkston Heath in between those two places, but Barkston Heath was used differently.
These are all
and more later on.
They're all from Cranley.
Yes, from Cranwell, yeah.
Cranwell, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Now, what's your memory of your first solo? Any detail about it?
I honestly can't remember too much about it, but I'm pretty certain that it was a longer sortie than normal.
Carry on then.
Yeah. Well, I was just checked out by Flight Lieutenant Lewis, who's the flight commander there, and I'd had two previous instructors, but mainly all my flying with Alan Palmer up to that stage, and I can't remember too much at all about my first solo. I think it was just, you know, obviously quite exhilarating to go off by myself, because the odd person, about three or four of the guys on the entry, of course, had flown before. There was somebody like at my school, Q Oswell, had actually led the coronation flypast, and it was all timed and worked beautifully. So he was doing a chipmunk cross country as an air cadet, and he was on my entry, and he was right at the front of the coronation flypast, just ahead of our going to Cranwell. That was at Odeon. And then, of course, it was beyond that. It's a lot of consolidation and introduction to more advanced turning and advanced max rate turns eventually. Steep turns and... Well, max rate turns come a little later, but to start with, you just learn how to turn accurately at height. And the one key thing about learning to fly, as you probably know, all the time was lookout, which was stressed quite correctly. And then even later as an instructor, I mean, it was the one thing you had to keep dinning into people, that they had to keep their eyes open all the time. And then gradual introduction to more advanced flying, which was instrument flying, in other words, simulated flying and actual flying in bad weather, and then introduction to navigation. And that was quite a thrilling thing to do. You tended to do your dual sortie and then almost a mirror image of that. So you would go up to, I can remember quite early on being tasked, well, and I believe it was done dual, but I'm wondering now, it must have been done. But I can remember being tasked to fly up to Scunthorpe, which was quite a lot of crud coming out of Scunthorpe. You know, I think probably about 6,000 or 7,000 feet, something like that, I was in the chipmunk, and asked to sketch out the industrial areas. And I thought that's quite an interesting thing at a very early stage to be asked to do, and bring back a sketch map of the railway and the industrial areas and the, you know, where were the key targets up in Scunthorpe. And in those days, there were often, particularly Scunthorpe and one or two of those other towns further north, there was quite a lot of pollution coming up, and often you could almost tell where the town was because of that. And in those days, you didn't have motorways, of course, and so railways tended to stick out much more, and lakes, etc. No real problem in the chipmunk, apart from the fact, as you probably know, the slower you fly, the larger the drift angle, which means your navigation is probably more difficult in a slow aircraft because the wind and the variation of the wind, depending, particularly since you're normally doing a triangular or at least a triangular track to get back to your base, the wind's affecting you from different sides at different times, and almost invariably the weather forecast's not right that you've planned for, and you're stooging so slowly that the effect of the wind is quite marked, and that means you've got a high drift angle, which may or may not be right in terms of your calculation. So navigation, surprisingly, is often far easier when you're bombing along at 420 knots later, where you've got very little effect normally of the wind. At low level, I'm talking about.
Anything else you're learning in this sort of second phase of training? You know, you've done your solo, now you're on your second phase.
Well, yes, on the consolidation phase after solo, you've obviously got to consolidate your circuit work, being able to do a variety of takeoffs and landings in the correct way, and roller landings, and different types of landings, and short takeoffs and short landings. More applicable those in a piston aircraft, where you can it's a more relevant thing, because really you tend not to do short landings in a jet aircraft. The only way you can do it is to stop cock, to actually shut the engine down as soon as you've touched down in emergency. And of course, by then you get more and more used to the effect of the torque that we talked about, the precessional effect of the large gyroscopic effect of the propeller, the big propeller at the front, even the affecting in the chipmunk, which really made them very good trainers, the piston aircraft, because they would weed out people that were unlikely to make good aircrew much earlier. I mean, we lost three at the pre-solo stage. I'd forgotten. I thought there were only two, but in fact there were three, because one immediately went equipment. Our only coloured guy, so we were rather pleased to have him. He was from Mauritius, and sadly later, although he'd done equipment once, he wasn't able to fly, and he was a very intelligent bloke. Sadly, he later converted to become a navigator, and then was killed in one of the Canberra accidents in Germany. And really, all I'm saying, and we might deal with this later, was that when we did switch over to the Jet Provost later as a trainer, it was more difficult to weed people out, and often a lot of money was spent on...
That wasn't Cranwell, was it?
No.
Now, what else about Cranwell? How far did your training get in Cranwell? Anything else that we haven't covered with the air side of it, the flying? Because you go on to the flying training school afterwards, don't you? So.
Oh, well, not really, no. We got our wings at Cranwell, but they were slightly strange wings, although we were very lucky, our particular course, because we had these four different types of aircraft. We started on the chipmunk, and then we converted to the Provost was coming in.
You did that at Cranwell?
The Piston Provost, oh yeah. And then...
Well, what was the Provost like?
Well, the Provost was even better, more powerful, because the whole point of the Provost was, and quite surprisingly, Percival learned a lot from that, because the Percival Prentice was not really, it was a bit ugly, and it wasn't really a good trainer at all. And a problem of the chipmunk, not too bad a problem, was that you hadn't got the power to do continuous aerobatics. Now, and it took time to get to height, and the piston provost was far better on that front. And it really, in some ways, it looked like a real aircraft because of its stance. I mean, it looked surprisingly like a slightly downsized, although not too downsized, version of even the FW-190. There was a certain resemblance with its stance there that you thought, you know, it was a real aircraft. That you were now not in a tandem trainer anymore, but you're side by side with some limitations on that, you know, because I think I said I've always preferred the tandem, and people tended to go one way or the other. But the only real problem about side by side trainers was when you started with formation and you were the wrong side to do formation more easily, you know, because you can imagine if you had to look across the cockpit and then you've got to also line everything up and judge your in-out. That was one of the difficulties of it.
Had you started formation flying then?
Well, we did formation. Formation was really left to later, as with night flying, and there was a kind of progression. In my day, the next step after solo, as I say, I loosely use this word consolidation for your circuit work and improving your middle air work and your aerobatics. You were gradually tasked to get better and better at aerobatics.
Well, we haven't mentioned aerobatics at all. What aerobatics?
Well, you'd normally start with...
Was this in the chipmunk or the provost?
With a chipmunk, and then it would be the same thing on the provost, and then it would be the same thing on the Balliol, because I was fortunate to go on to the Balliol.
What about these aerobatics then?
Yeah. Almost invariably, the first aerobatic you were introduced to was the loop and the barrel roll. Now, people normally think of the barrel roll as being an easy thing, but in fact it's not. It's quite a difficult thing to do technically
do
correctly. It's really like the normal way we did it was to turn on one side and dive down so that you actually came through up through the horizon on the left side of a barrel, so to speak. After diving fairly deeply, you would begin on one side of the barrel, and then you pulled up into a sort of looping maneuver at the same time as turning, and at 90 degrees, in other words, when you were at the top of the barrel shape, you would actually have your wings vertical there, and then you would come down on the far side of the barrel with your wings parallel with the horizon, and then you'd go way below the horizon for the last three quarters of the barrel. Again, you'd have your wings vertical and then come out again to the side. But it's something that most people do it far too fast and not deeply enough. And then, as I say, you'd start with a loop, and then you have the torque effect. With a loop, of course, it's just a straight forward dive down, accelerate, and then as you're accelerating, you're using the obviously putting your power on to accelerate, and then as you come up, you're having increasing G, and then over the top, of course, it's decreasing the G because it's working the other way. You're getting a kind of minus one effect at the top of the loop, and then normally again. One of the early mistakes that you make is probably pulling down a bit too fast at the top of a loop, because your speed's very low at the top of a loop, and you've got to hang and fly a little further on. And then what was very satisfying was to hit your own slipstream coming out of the bottom of a loop, and that normally told you that you'd done the thing more or less perfectly. And then we did dual sorties, and then going off to do it by yourself, solo. And then after the loop and the barrel roll, you would progress on to your slow rolls.
Now, what about slow rolls then?
Slow roll was, again, probably the most difficult thing to do really well. And it varied from aircraft to aircraft, depending on the amount of fin size and rudder effect. And you're really rolling round a point on the horizon, and you started by just lifting your nose gently and then feeding on a bit of what was called your top rudder. You were rolling to the right, say if you were doing a slow roll to the right, and you'd be feeding in a little top rudder to keep the nose of the aircraft exactly in the same place, which had already to be lifting above the horizon, even though because you were increasing your angle of attack to maintain your straight and level aspect of your slow roll. And then halfway around the initiation of your roll, you'd be using a lot of top rudder to keep the nose up. And then as you're going on the second part of the roll, you'd have to really start pushing forward then to get the effect of the being your wings being upside down. You'd have to get the stick well forward. And then it was a very good coordination exercise. And then, of course, coming round the other way, you'd be using, again, you'd be feeding in the other rudder to keep your nose above the horizon. And then it was a question of coordinating everything, that you were rolling at this roughly at the right rate. And normally the most difficult thing was the last part of the roll actually coming out without whooshing, without sort of coming out not too neatly. But again, that was very satisfying later when one was doing low-level aerobatics to be able to do that perfectly.
Any other aerobatics you were learning then?
Well, quite early on you'd learn to do the sort of Cuban eight, which was really, and a roll off the top. A roll off the top is just a pull up to the vertical, and then like the first bit of a loop, and then at the top you've got extra speed because you've got more speed in the dive than for a normal loop. And on the top you just roll out, so you do a half roll off the top of a loop, and then you could do a full roll, or you could do a roll and a half and a reverse. But you obviously depends on your thrust weight ratio, what you could and couldn't do. But the piston provost was even more useful for as an aerobatic trainer, and it was a time to height. But many people said the chipmunk quite correctly, particularly those that stayed a long time on it. And it was in longer than it was in a long, long time, the chipmunk, longer than the tiger moth as a trainer.
So any other aerobatics? We've done a fair number of them now. But
yeah, well, then you'd learn also aileron turns, which, and upward charlies. Upward charlie is just
What's
a roll.
Aileron turn, you mentioned that.
Aileron turn is just when you're going vertically downwards, and you'd probably want on some aircraft to maybe have your dive brake out to stop you going down. But of course the chipmunk wouldn't have a dive brake. And you've got to be careful with a chipmunk of not overspeeding the prop, because you could cause problems with an overspeeding prop. So it probably wasn't the sort of thing you'd be doing too much in a chipmunk. But an aileron turn was just going straight down vertically and rolling in the vertical plane going downwards. And the upward charlie was the other way around. And again, you couldn't really do that effectively. You hadn't got the power in a chipmunk to do that. But if you got plenty of thrust later in an aircraft, you just pulled up to the vertical, and then you did your roll in the vertical plane, rolling around the vertical axis, so to speak.
And anything else?
Well, quite early on, what I didn't mention, obviously, you've got to, even before you do your first solo in those days, although I know there have been arguments to and fro on the topic, we all learned stall and spin recovery, just basic spin recovery before we went solo, and how to handle the stall with and without power. And again, the chipmunk was very good on that front.
Now, what is a stall and spin recovery? Just explain.
Well, the stall basically is each aircraft has a stalling speed that if you drop below that, you're really in trouble, because it's just literally falling out of the sky, and then you're very liable, if you misuse your controls, to flick into a spin. So it was de rigueur in those days to for anyone before they went solo to be able to be introduced quickly to stall and stall recovery, and then spin recovery as well. And spin basically is just a you're rolling at the same time as you're in the stalled condition, and you lose a lot of height very quickly. And different aircraft can and can't be spun, you know, and with a general rule of thumb, the faster the aircraft, the less likely you are to want to spin it. But the Hunter was very forgiving on that. And the Gnat had the most impressive rate of... But you really weren't supposed to spin the Gnat.
We'll come to
that. Yes.
Now, anything else you were learning in the aerobatics or field?
Well, I think that's about all the...
There's a fair amount there.
The basic aerobatics, yes. And then, of course, as I was saying, you learned how to turn at maximum rate quite early on.
What,
and
tell
perfection.
Us about that.
Well, that was really, it's almost like a combat maneuver, and you'll know that from your World War I experience, that often to save your life, you had to be able to turn well. And it was introduced quite early on to be able to turn at your actual maximum rate. And you could normally work that out for any aircraft and had that in your head. And again, it was turning just off the stall with the maximum amount of power and either a level maximum turn, which you'd learn, or a descending maximum rate turn. There were sort of two aspects to that. And then at the same time, of course, almost on every sortie, you'd be doing a little instrument flying, as I mentioned, simulated. And quite early on, and I remember vividly, being quite impressed with the whole process. The Chipmunk had this rather very good setup that you could completely, you put on a pair of blue goggles, and you had the yellow hood that went all the yellow panels that went all the way round, and the instructor would have perfect vision through the yellow hood, but you with your blue goggles, it would just be as though you were at night, you know, as not exactly as night, but as though you were completely instrument flying with no horizon to practice your instrument flying. And that was a very good system, and they had the same. I'm pretty certain we had the same in the Balliol, though we didn't always use it because of the...
Let's go on to the Balliol was the third of the aircraft.
Yes, sorry.
What was the Balliol like? We don't know anything about it.
No, the piston, the Provost, which was, of course, the piston Provost then with the Leonides in it, Leonides engine, we really only did two-thirds of our flying on the Chipmunk in terms of basic flying, and then about a third on the piston Provost. And then the Harvard had just left, and although I was fortunate to fly the Harvard just very briefly later, in fact very quite early on, while I was still, before I'd even started my advanced flying, when I went off to Africa on a separate visit, but the Harvard had just stopped and was being replaced by the Balliol. So by the time we got onto our advanced flying, we transferred from having flown two-thirds or more on the Chipmunk, then onto the Provost, and then we converted also onto the Balliol.
Now, what was the Balliol? I don't know that aircraft at all.
Oh, the Balliol really...
Who made it?
...was a most attractive aircraft, but its timing was probably not of the best. It was made by Bolton Pohl, who made a lot of the turrets in the war, as you know. And it had a Merlin engine in it, so it was really almost like a side-by-side Spitfire, because it had all the thrust. It had a down-rated, I think it was 1,200 horsepower in the version that we had, which was down-rated. But it was very much, it had all the feel of a Merlin, and you had to snake down. You could fly it off the grass, but we normally flew it off the runways. And by this time, I was flying from Parkeston Heath, because by then Parkeston Heath was used for the advanced flying with the Balliols. And Parkeston Heath is
from Cranwell.
Between, that's right, it's south of Cranwell, between Cranwell and Grantham, halfway roughly.
No, it was a prop aircraft.
Yes, yeah, again,
it
was called an advanced piston. And again, we were most fortunate. I think all of us felt very privileged, really, just to see the end of that era with the advanced piston trainer. And it was quite a step up.
What was the Balliol like to fly?
Well, many people said if you could fly the Balliol, you could fly anything. But
why?
I think,
was it difficult?
I think it was largely because of what we've talked about slightly, this torque stall, and that you could ground loop it. It had a tail wheel. You locked the tail wheel just before you took off, and there would be a tremendous amount of torque stall potential on it because of the sheer power of the engine, because the engine would pick up extremely rapidly, and you'd have so much power there that the propeller just could not absorb the power. And what would happen was the engine, we're talking really about low speed, but of course, you know, you land at low speed and you would be demonstrated this in the air. I'm almost certain that we had some sort of rough demonstration about that, where you put an awful lot of power on at low speed, so you're just above the stall, and the aircraft would rotate the other way. So in other words, there'd be so much power that it would be rotating the wrong way. And the aircraft would be rotating effectively around the propeller. And a good friend of mine nearly killed himself on night flying with this, and he was very, very lucky because he actually hit the ground, and amazingly his ailerons were still working, but only just. There was just, you could put a thin feeler gauge in where his ailerons had been damaged, and but they were still actually working. And again, what was surprising about both the Balliol and later the Gnat, they were both looked upon as being rather hairy aircraft, and yet partly because I think people were much more cautious and careful to know how to deal with them, they had surprisingly low number of fatalities. Although with the Balliol, there was the problem of this business of opening up after. One of the things that you tended to practice was engine failures after takeoff, which I didn't mention, which was something that you'd learn very early on, how to set about landing in a field, in an emergency landing. I didn't mention that in the chipmunk.
Tell us about that then, practicing engine emergency landing.
Well, the two, normally you started with practicing an engine failure at altitude, and then later engine failure immediately after takeoff, and in all the piston aircraft, and then you did a slightly different variation on jet aircraft with it, and that was just called an engine failure after takeoff.
So what was an emergency landing after takeoff? What was the procedure?
Well, normally the procedure, because often with the engine at full power, you're more likely to have a failure then than anything when you're climbing away, and it's obviously at a critical stage. And the important thing is to let the aircraft stay flying, so that you can't, obviously, if all your power's gone, you can't keep your aircraft climbing, otherwise you're going to be in big trouble. Your speed is going to be lost very quickly, so you've got to very quickly get it into a glide descent, and then pick a field to the left or the right, unless you've got sufficient height that you can turn back towards the airfield itself, and that sometimes can be a slightly dangerous thing to do. But what we did practice.
Didn't they ban that? I thought that was the most dangerous thing. Stall if you turn back.
Yeah, turn backs later. You're right. There was for a while we did them, because I can remember on the Vampires. And then they were thought of as being dangerous to practice. They tended, I think, just to be practiced with instructors, because this argument was still going on when I came back later as an instructor several years later. But
I thought the thing was that you didn't turn back towards the airfield because you'd lose more speed.
Yes, unless
in the turn, and that would cause the aircraft to stall.
That's right, and of course you'd be flying downwind as well, so you'd be extra. You're quite right that normally, if you had an engine failure in a piston aircraft shortly after takeoff, you'd normally land ahead, and that is more normal. And then the other thing one had to remember to do, particularly with all the piston aircraft, and particularly the Balliol, was to warm it up on the way down, because if you'd had it in the idling position for a long time, it wouldn't want to open up quite so quickly. So you'd have to clear the plugs and and just open up and shut down again without sort of cheating on your practice engine failure. And you do the same thing from altitude, and it was sometimes a bit more difficult to do from altitude, because if you'd got almost too much height to start with, you'd obviously got plenty of height, but it very quickly you could end up in the wrong position when you were turning downwind, because you'd be doing a practice sort of descending circuit to land in a field, and you'd obviously that would all be done by either side slipping in or using a lot of flap or both sometimes, which you could do easily with a chipmunk to land reasonably easily. And you had to pick the field and hope that it was all right, there was nothing across it. And that was quite an interesting exercise and really made you think. And I can remember vividly Johnny Grobler, who'd just come back from winning the at Central Flying School, his aerobatic thing, always used to immediately throw the aircraft when he said for a practice force landing, inverted and push. So one would be pushing forward when one would be studying at low level the landing ground below that you were looking at, the field. But very quickly all that sort of went for a chop, because once you are on more advanced aircraft, you know, that became a thing of the past.